shoes?
What's the matter, Morty?
Great gowns, beautiful gowns.
Fashion has changed.
No, it hasn't.
Hi, I'm Lauren Garoni.
And I'm Chelsea Fairless.
And welcome to another episode of the Every Outfit Podcast.
It has been yet another upsetting week here in America. Our hearts are with everyone in Minnesota, but we do have a bit of good news to start the show. Or is it bad news? I can't really tell.
It's kind of upsetting news, but in a great way. Those VIP fuckettes know, because we talked about this in our mannequin episode, but I'm sure the fuckettes are aware that there is a Sarah Jessica Parker wax figure. And we were joking before the holidays, if not us, who would be the owners of this? And so over the holidays, I engaged Obnoxious Antiques.
That's the antique dealer that has acquired many wax figures of celebrities from a regional wax museum that went out of business. We have to figure out exactly which one.
Yes, I was confused about what it was called because I have spoken to, or shall I say, texted so many different individual men. This is all to say, guys, we bought the Sarah Jessica Parker wax figure. I negotiated with a man named John.
And we think it's arrived, but the scary thing is that it's arrived in three separate boxes. I don't know why I expected it to be shipped like in a coffin style box.
Well, it leads us to believe that we're going to have to reassemble her, which, yes, I was also not expecting.
Her head is definitely in one box.
Oh, God.
It's like the most seven ass shit.
This is obviously a visual medium showing this doll. And so we have decided that we are going to make a video exploring our journey of acquiring and restoring the Sarah Jessica Parker wax figure, because I think we can all agree it's not exactly giving Carrie Bradshaw.
She needs some help. I just wanted to put it out to you guys. We're going to get a makeup artist to design the makeup, but we will need to find someone that has experience painting wax figures or something of that nature to redo her face. So if anyone knows anyone, especially in LA, that specializes in such things, please let us know.
Do you think it's going to be like, have you ever seen those videos where people repaint Barbies and they like melt off their face, basically? Like, is that what's going to have to happen?
I think it's going to have to be wiped off with some sort of chemical or something that will also not harm the wax. Again, it's such a highly specific thing. We really need to find someone with experience, with wax figure experience. So that's one thing we're working on.
You know, I mean, not to toot my own horn, but I feel like I've really copped it because this creepy wax figure is going to live at my place for the foreseeable future. And also, I drew the short straw and had to listen to this Chris Noth interview in its entirety. I know none of you listened to this podcast. I did for all of us, not just the Entertainment Tonight clips.
So what was the podcast that he went on?
He went on a podcast called Really Famous with Kara Meyer Robinson. Is this a good time to mention that our podcast editor, this was shot at his studio? So there is something about podcasts with celebrities that are sometimes uninteresting because even though they are used to doing press interviews, I feel like when celebrities go on or actors go on podcasts, they're like, oh, this is just a long form conversation. This is not something that's going to be consumed by a lot of people. Well, first of all, the podcast begins with, she's like, what's your morning routine? And Chris Noth goes through a very long explanation about waking up early and his kids. It then devolves into him not remembering if he had to get his teeth whitened for Sex and the City. And I'm like, well, you definitely had to get a spray tan for the first film. That I know.
Yeah, we want to hear about that.
So they're like, we were introduced by our friend Joe. I'm like, okay, Joe. Then they clarify they were introduced by the actor Joe Mantegna.
Oh, he was introduced to this podcaster, you mean?
Yes. That's how these two people were introduced.
Yeah, because I'm like, why this podcast?
And why would you not cancel this appearance after your latest kerfuffle, which is how he refers to it, in the press?
Okay, so let's get into what he says about Sarah Jessica Parker and the rape allegations.
Well, he won't use that word. He dances around the word, but he will never use the R word.
Well, I get that. Like, once you've been accused of rape, you kind of want to put some distance between yourself and a rapey vibe.
I have to say that this therapist is a genius because the way that she gets him to talk about the Sarah Jessica...
Wait, she's a therapist? Come again?
Yeah.
Okay, so she's a therapist that has a podcast.
Oh, yeah. Sorry, did I not make that clear? Yes.
No, I have no idea who this woman is and what this podcast is and why any of this happened. I have no clue. So you're going to have to tell us. Anyway, continue.
Okay. She gets him to talk about the Sex and the City situation because she asks him what he's reading now. And he talks about how he's reading self-help books. And she's like, oh, are you reading self-help books because of, you know, and he's like, the mess that has been my life the last 5 years? Yeah. And then she asks this.
So everybody's wondering if you and Sarah Jessica Parker are friends or have parted ways, I think
not.
Is what
we're
it
not
is.
Friends. No, I think that's pretty obvious.
Why is that obvious?
Well, mostly, and I'll try to make this brief, the statement that they put out, which was nothing more than brand management, really, you know, none of it was sad. It was disappointing. It was surprising because you need to call me and hear my side of this. And you've known me for many years and we've worked for many years and that didn't happen. So when that statement came out, which is nothing more than brand management, I mean, let's call it what it is. It's don't spoil my gravy train. And I get it. That's more Hollywood than Hollywood. But before you make that statement, you know me, you've known me all these years. Give me a call so I can give you the real scoop about this.
So throughout this interview, as you heard in that clip, he keeps referring to the real scoop. He also explains his behavior. As I mentioned, he won't use the word rape, but he keeps referring to his behavior as reckless and insists that he's not that, meaning a rapist. But this interviewer doesn't dig down into what the reckless behavior is. I assume it's inviting young women up to his apartment that I guess is on 9th and University, which he reveals earlier in this interview.
Well, after the rape allegations came out, there were further allegations that were more about sexual harassment, as I recall.
Yes. Again, he doesn't refer to anyone by their name, but he discusses how he wishes that there had been a trial because he would have been exonerated. And an example he gives is, he goes, there was an actress that accused me of being drunk on set, and it was investigated, I assume, by SAG. He doesn't say who, but if not SAG, I don't know who would have investigated this. But he won't say the actress's name. So I went back, and he's referring to Zoe Lister-Jones.
Right.
Who not just accused him of being drunk and inappropriate on the Law and Order set, of which he was an actress. There's more to that, because I went back and found her Instagram story. She used to work at the club that he owned during the time of Sex and the City and witnessed him being sexually inappropriate with women.
Yes, I'm inclined to believe all of these allegations about Chris Noth because of the scope of them, because of how similar a lot of them are.
And also, while he's like, I'm not a rapist, he keeps saying, I behaved recklessly and that's what I regret. And I'm like, what? But what is the reckless behavior? So you were with these women.
Right.
And you regret that. He goes on to say that the people that he was like, you know who was the coolest during this whole situation? The woman I knew the least, Bridget Moynihan, because she gave a comment that was like, hey, I don't know what the allegations are. I can't comment on it. And it's like, well...
He was like, I always loved Natasha more.
And then he's also like, you know who really had my back? Queen Latifah. And I was like, what is this about? Because he's like, you know, she was just like, it's about justice. So I went back and found the quote. I forgot at the time because the timeline was so compressed because it's like, and just like that, the first episode came out. This is my memory. I believe it's true, though. It's like that first episode came out, big dies. And then that Hollywood Reporter article came out like all within days of each other.
Yeah, I think it was like a couple days later.
I didn't realize that he was on The Equalizer at the time.
Me neither.
Which was led by Queen Latifah. And so her actual quote is this. Chris' character, obviously a big part of the show, and it was amazing chemistry, Latifah continued. And my feeling is justice has to prevail regardless. I just want the right things to be done, you know? And I'm like, well, she's not exactly defending you. Again, Bridget Moynihan nor Queen Latifah are defending you. They're just sort of like, I don't know what this is all about.
Yeah.
The therapist then goes on to make a point that I don't think Chris Noth truly understands, because he begins speaking about how he didn't realize that big meant so much to people.
Oh, come on.
He's like, I'm just an actor. Like, he basically is like, I completely forgot about Sex and the City. So the interviewer is trying to make the point that it's like, oh, well, who's that actor who played Aiden? And he supplies, oh, John Corbett. She goes, well, you know, if these allegations were made against him, people would find it harder to believe, because they think that Aiden wouldn't do something like that. And, you know, people look at Mr. Big as more of a Lothario. And so that's why they were more likely to believe the comments. Again, she doesn't say this directly, but that's what she's trying to say. And he doesn't understand what she's trying to say. He's like, no, people just loved Big. And I disappointed them because my behavior was like so opposite of something Big would do, because he loved Carrie. And she's like, no, no.
Okay, but we don't think that Mr. Big is a fucking rapist.
I mean, how many times have we been like, Mr. Big is friends with Jeffrey Epstein?
Okay, sure. But a violent person whose ex-girlfriend has a restraining order taken out against him?
She doesn't ask about Beverly Johnson.
Yeah. And also, again, another reason why I'm inclined to believe this Chris Noth stuff is I talked to someone really close to the show whose name you all would recognize. And they were like, yeah, he had rumors even back then about his behavior towards women. You wouldn't want to go on a date with him. So I think that that's why a lot of people, including potentially some of his co-stars, were like, this is probably true, and didn't side with him or publicly defend him.
Well, it's also funny that clearly he is not media trained.
No.
Him going on this podcast illustrates that. But for him to be offended, I guess he's not offended. He keeps referring to it as like, I get it. It's brand management to release this statement, which is also insulting, because he's like, to say that these three women got together and published this statement just for brand management to keep the gravy train going is so cynical, because, you know, the subtext of that is like, well, they didn't even believe what they were saying.
Yeah.
They just needed to keep the show going. And it's like, but you weren't in the show anymore.
Exactly. But also, can you imagine how much pressure these three actresses were to make a statement about Chris Noth? Like, remember the DMs that we were getting during that time? Because the day that the Hollywood Reporter article came out, we did not immediately post about it. And then we started getting many DMs. You guys are supporting a rapist. Why are you not talking about this? Blah, blah, blah. And it's like, people are fucking psychos. We ultimately did post about it, but this is just how the internet works.
Well, on the other side of internet psychos, which you brought to my attention, I think it was last week, is how many stans Chris Noth has.
Yeah.
Can I just read you the top comments from this podcast? I would be willing to sign a petition to get Chris back on our TVs and big screen. Killing Big off in the first episode was beyond dumb, and the show never quite recovered. He is a TV legend and handsome AF. He is 71. Heart emoji. I hope Chris realizes how much support he has.
Again, this is giving like prison wife energy.
I forgot to mention that when Chris Noth is talking about the Sex and the City stuff, because she really drills down about, you know, what is this statement and who were the women? And again, he won't refer to anyone by their first name. So she's supplying each actress. Sarah Jessica Parker. He's like, yeah. Cynthia Nixon. Yeah. Kristen Davis, yeah. And then she goes, not Kim Cattrall? And goes, no, no, no. And I'm like, is she purposely playing dumb to try to get a morsel out of him? Or does she genuinely not know the drama about Kim Cattrall and Sex and the City and Sarah Jessica Parker and that whole fallout?
It would be insane to have Chris Noth as a guest on the show if she didn't have some awareness of that. But I don't understand the strategy from Chris's perspective, because in my mind, the only real cultural cachet that he has left is his association with this show, the fact that people still watch this show on streamers, so it's still in the conversation. Too many people have forgotten about Law and Order because I mean, for one thing, that show had such a massive cast, if you're thinking of all the Law and Orders together. And it was a really long time ago.
Oh, don't worry. He shits on Dick Wolf, too. She's like, Law and Order, what happened there? And he goes, you know, I was on it for 5 years and then Dick didn't want to pay me more. So it was time to leave. I'm like, okay, well, there goes your reappearance on the Law and Order, right? They brought it back a third time at this point.
Yeah. I just don't see an advantage in him obviously coming for Dick Wolf, but especially coming out against Sarah Jessica Parker, who's like the most beloved person in American culture. She's like our Princess Diana, basically.
I mean, certainly to us and other people. Yeah, she's America's sweetheart. Yeah, for American television. I won't relitigate. He does get into the Instagram comment because we talked about this a couple weeks ago and he doesn't have more to say. Although what I found interesting, or I should say he doesn't have more to justify his comment, which we should say was one word.
Yeah.
Which was, yeah, to someone being like, fuck Sarah Jessica Parker and her award, right? But he does say, he's like, I didn't think it would get picked up so much. He goes, I wasn't thinking and that was dumb and it was off the cuff and stupid and I shouldn't have done it. But like, he goes, I've written other comments that no one has ever picked up on. And I'm like, okay, do I need to like be scrubbing Chris Noss' comment section for other Sarah Jessica Parker shit talking?
I think you could probably get ChatGPT to do that for you for the sake of your mental health.
I do appreciate it. You know what's better than flowers that die in 3 days? Matching underwear. Seriously, MeUndies has cracked the code on Valentine's Day gifts with their matching underwear for couples. It's cute, it's intimate, and you'll wear them more than once. You heard me right. MeUndies makes matching underwear specifically for couples. That means every style comes in coordinating prints so you and your partner can match. Boxer briefs, trunks, briefs for him, bikinis, thongs, boy shorts, cheeky styles for her. Same print, different fits, all made from their signature ultra-modal fabric that feels impossibly soft. Even I couldn't resist getting Paul and I a matching pair of MeUndies when I saw their dinosaur heart print. I'm not going to tell you what cut of underwear we prefer, but let's just say it's not what you would think. Valentine's Day is February 14th, so if you want these delivered in time, order soon. This is the gift that keeps giving long after the holiday is over. Over 30 million pairs have been sold and 90,000 five-star reviews. People love these because they actually fit well and feel amazing. Make this Valentine's Day one to remember with matching underwear from MeUndies. To get exclusive deals up to 50% off, go to MeUndies.com/outfit and enter promo code OUTFIT. That's MeUndies.com/outfit, promo code OUTFIT for up to 50% off. All right, if Evan Handler's on a podcast, you know, you need to bite the bullet and watch that one, okay?
I love him. I would have no problem doing that.
All right, should we get into Oscar nominations?
Sure.
Oscar nominations came out last week. Sinners became the most nominated film in Oscars history with 16 nominations. The previous record was 14 nominations, which films like All About Eve, Titanic, and La La Land have had.
La La Land, for fuck's sake.
La La Land, which came out 10 years ago, really feels like a fever dream. Although I am hoping for maybe a Moonlight La La Land situation where, you know, we get some older actress to accidentally say F1 has won, but really it's Sinners.
They should bring Warren Beatty and Faye Dunaway back to do Best Picture. Like, that would be so funny to commemorate the 10th anniversary of the La La Land Moonlight debacle.
Well, as we learned in our last VIP episode about the Beckhams, she's busy filming her latest film with Nicola Peltz Beckham.
This poor woman.
So, as I said, nominees for Best Picture, F1, which was a surprise. Chelsea, it's
especially to me because I've never heard of this movie.
I was about to explain. Just basically, it's the film Days of Thunder, but with Brad Pitt, and it's about Formula One, not NASCAR.
Don't give two shits. Never going to see that.
So Begonia, Frankenstein, Hamnet, Marty Supreme, One Battle After Another, The Secret Agent, Sentimental Value, Sinners, Train Dreams. So Focus Features has two nominated Best Pictures, Warner Brothers has three, A24 has one, and Neon has two.
There you have it.
You're keeping score, right, Joe? So for Best Director, Chloe Zhao for Hamnet, Josh Shafty for Marty Supreme, Paul Thomas Anderson for One Battle After Another, Joachim Trier for Sentimental Value, and Ryan Coogler for Sinners. Coogler is only the seventh Black filmmaker to be nominated for Best Director. He joined Spike Lee, who was not nominated for Do the Right Thing. He was not nominated for Best Director until Black Klansman.
Crazy.
John Singleton is actually the first Black director to be nominated in the category for Boys in the Hood. Lee Daniels, Precious, Steve McQueen, 12 Years a Slave, Barry Jenkins, If Beale Street Could Talk, and Jordan Peele.
Has anyone won?
No. Spike Lee has won. He won Best Original or Best Adapted Screenplay for Black Klansman. I believe a Black director has won for a short film, either documentary or narrative. I can't remember.
Well, that's depressing.
Should we get into the fact that we finally watched Sinners?
Sure. We did finally watch Sinners.
Can I just say, it was our mistake not to see this movie in the theaters. Having
big mistake. Huge.
I just want to explain how at least I missed the film in theaters, which is I watched that Kodak Ryan Coogler YouTube video where he discusses the different film formats. We have places in Los Angeles that screen films in 70mm, and they were sold out for weeks and weeks. And I tried to go to those screenings, but they were sold out. And then I had a baby, then the movie was out of theaters, then I had to watch it on streaming.
But I think it's true of all action movies and horror movies that they're just better in a theater with an audience.
Yeah, there were definitely moments that I was like, oh, this would have been a lot more fun with a crowd.
For sure. I like Sitters a lot. It draws you in. It subverts your expectations. And it has a very memorable ending, or shall I say a series of endings, which I think is why people are still talking about it months later.
It's an incredibly fun film. I will say I enjoyed it very much, but I was not expecting it to be such an homage to the Robert Rodriguez Quentin Tarantino film From Dusk Till Dawn.
I know, because I had ignored all of the discourse about Sinners because I hadn't seen it. And especially after I learned that there are all these Oscar nominations, I was like, what is this going to be? So yes, to have the reveal that it is a Robert Rodriguez type movie was kind of shocking, just because historically those kinds of films aren't recognized by the Oscars.
And I did Google this halfway through the film. I'm like, are other people mentioning this? And the answer is yes. But I just want to say, From Dusk Till Dawn is not a good movie. Sinners is a good movie. It has much more important themes than From Dusk Till Dawn. I do believe that superior art can be made from inferior references. I would give anything to hear, I'm sure, Quentin Tarantino's terrible takes about Sinners.
Okay, but I would be legit pissed if I was Robert Rodriguez, because I would be like, because he never gets shit. Has he even ever been nominated for anything once?
No, he doesn't get his due. And in interviews, Ryan Coogler has said how he was inspired by Robert Rodriguez.
But it's not even like the plot of it, which is very From Dusk Till Dawn. It's like the way it looks. It's like some of the action sequences. I just feel like I'm watching one of those movies. Not Spy Kids, obviously, but the other ones.
Well, like From Dusk Till Dawn, and there's only a few movies that actually are like this, where you think it's one thing and it becomes a monster movie. Predator is another film like this. You think you're following mercenaries and like, boom, the Predator's hunting you. And From Dusk Till Dawn, like Sinners, the first hour of the movie, right, we're following these brothers on their journey to start a club. I also was not expecting it to be a 24-hour film, which I love 24-hour movies.
Me too. See, to me, I expected it to be an action horror kind of movie just because I had seen the trailer at some point.
But you were not expecting...
I mean, I get it. The first half is more of a drama. Then it abruptly switches to being an action movie or a horror movie or whatever.
Yes.
An action horror dramedy? Is that what we could call this? A Southern Gothic grindhouse kind of vibe?
About generational trauma and using vampirism as a metaphor? Not even a metaphor. As a direct response of like how dire and terrible it is to be a Black man in the South in the 1930s. Like,
I did like that the vampires were like, it's actually just better to be a vampire than it is to be a person of color during Jim Crow.
Yeah. I also loved the different shades, like the moral gray in each character. I thought every character was incredibly rich. I love twins. Had no idea Haley Steinfeld was 1/8 African-American.
You learn something new every day.
And we'll get to it when we get to Best Supporting Actor. But I fucking love Delroy Lindo.
Yeah.
He's not in enough stuff.
He was very good.
He's incredible in this film. Before we go on, do we want to discuss maybe the most talked about sequence in the film, which is the younger character, their cousin, who is playing guitar so amazingly that we are shown every musician from past and future?
When that happened, I was kind of like, I hate this, but then I was like, it's kind of good. Like, it kind of works. It's memorable. And that's the thing about this movie. I feel like there are many parts of it that people will remember in 10 years, which I can't say about La La Land, honestly.
Jesus Christ, no. Well, as someone who I've seen all of Ryan Coogler's films, and I forgot how maximalist of a director he is, because Creed was very grounded. And again, the first half of this film is grounded in a reality. You can tell how well researched the script is. And then this fantasy sequence where you have everything from geisha dancers,
I forgot about her,
to who I think is like Sly from Sly and the Family Stone. I'm like, oh, I forgot how maximalist Ryan Coogler can be. And also the thing that is unique to this film, the discourse I don't understand about Sinners, and specifically Ryan Coogler, and it seems to happen every time he makes a film, and the man is only 39, by the way. His films have grossed billions of dollars. He's treated like this young upstart. Because the notable thing about Sinners is when he sold it, he took it out on spec, he went to all the studios, he got the budget he wanted, and then he leveraged that in 25 years, the rights revert back to him.
That's cool.
Which is unprecedented. Like, the last person who was able to do this, ironically, was Quentin Tarantino with Once Upon a Time in Hollywood.
Well, after the Black Panther movies, he certainly had leverage.
Oh, for sure. And I do think that there is a conversation continuing from the film in the way that Ryan Coogler gets the rights back, in the sense that, you know, the film is about, for the other three people who haven't seen it, you know, this white Irish vampire wants to make the Michael B. Jordan, Smoke and Stack, twin brothers, their cousin, Preacher Boy, a vampire because of his musical talent and how he believes he can get his ancestors back. And there's something about white people colonizing black music, which this is a metaphor for, of like the fact that the studio...
Their music was terrible, might I just say. Like the parts in Sinners where they are singing like their folk songs, or I know not enough about music. Is it bluegrass? It's something. That shit, I was like, can you please stop singing these goddamn songs?
You were with them initially. You were like, you know what? You shouldn't be let into this club. I don't care how much money you have. This music sucks.
Even that scene where Hailee Steinfeld went out and they started like singing their like hillbilly music and she was like, wow, this actually slaps. I was like, no, this song sucks. Run, bitch.
That's the 7/8 white person inside of her saying that. She's like, you know, this is kind of good.
I can kind of fuck with this. Maybe I will let them in.
But the fact that he gets the movie back after 25 years, so that probably in 25 years, whomever white studio head or whatever AI controlled studio we live in, like, can't be like, you know what? Let's remake Sinners or sequelize it to death.
Right.
I mean, they're doing that with The Matrix.
I've been ignoring all things Matrix for years now, so I will continue to do that. Which is not to say I didn't watch the first two, but anyway.
Not the third.
They lost me with the third.
I haven't even seen the third. I don't think anyone has seen the third.
Are there three all up, or are there like 20?
Well, are you including the Animatrix?
I don't want to know about whatever that is, so no.
Was it Lana Wachowski? One of the Wachowskis came back, and there was a pandemic-era fourth Matrix film, which I did not watch, but it has Keanu and Carrie Ann Moss. But I guess, from what I understand, it was a commentary on sequel culture. Anyway.
So it's Scream 2, 3, 4, and 5? Is that how many we're up to? I can't wait for the new one. I saw a billboard for it on Sunset Boulevard when I was driving here.
Are we up to 7? I missed 7. We're on 8?
I don't know, but it comes out on February 28th.
Where's Patrick Dempsey? He's not her husband anymore.
Whose husband?
Neve Campbell. Don't you remember? The lore is that Patrick Dempsey is the cop from the third film and she marries him.
Oh, I completely forgot about all that.
Today we have a new sponsor, Nowadays, which is soon to become your new favorite alcohol alternative. Nowadays is a zero-proof THC beverage that delivers a clean, reliable buzz with no hangover, no empty calories, and no regrets. Just bold flavor, good energy, and full presence. What I love about Nowadays is the different options they offer. Now, they have their canned cocktail, which is my personal favorite, in great flavors like tropical, berry, citrus, and my favorite, spicy lime. And most importantly, it comes in two different strengths, 5 milligram and 10 milligram. Now, while I love their canned beverages, I was very taken with what I will call their spirit bottle, which delivers 2 milligrams, 5 milligrams, or 10 milligram shots of THC that you can enjoy by itself, on ice, or mix it up like I do with your favorite flavored sparkling water. It has a quick onset time, the canned beverage is just 30 calories, and best of all, no hangover. Visit trynowadays.com/outfit to get 20% off your order. That's trynowadays.com/outfit or use code outfit at checkout. Drink responsibly. Must be 21 or older. Also, I swear we will get back to the nominees, but Patrick Dempsey has a new show where he is a contract killer or a serial killer who has early onset dementia.
Not watching that.
Okay, best actor. Timmy and Marty Supreme, Leonardo DiCaprio in One Battle After Another, Ethan Hawke in Blue Moon, Michael B. Jordan in Sinners, Wagner Moura in The Secret Agent, notably missing, Jesse Plemons for Begonia. And this was such a notable snub that his partner, Kirsten Dunst, posted a meme about him not getting nominated on Instagram stories. That's how mad she was. She got on Instagram.
He should have been nominated, but whenever these conversations come up about people getting snubbed, it does kind of annoy me a little bit because it suggests that someone that was nominated was undeserving.
Oh, maybe you'll feel that way when I get into the best actress category. You have Jessie Buckley in Hamnet, Rose Byrne in If I Had Legs, I'd Kick You, Renata Reinsve in Sentimental Value, Emma Stone in Begonia, and Chase Infinity for One Battle After Another, because Kate Hudson in Song Sung Blue was nominated.
Okay, but to be fair, we haven't seen that, so we can't really weigh in on whether or not she deserves it. And everyone is like, she's major in that movie.
Who's everybody? All the Australians that you saw when you were there for the holiday?
No, not them, just people I know that have seen that movie.
Fine. Best Supporting Actor, Benicio del Toro in One Battle After Another, Jacob Elordi in Frankenstein. I guess I need to go back and actually finish this movie now that he's Oscar nominated for it. Sean Penn in One Battle After Another, Stellan Skarsgård in Sentimental Value, and as I said earlier, Delroy Lindo in Sinners. I think people thought that Miles Canton, who played Sammy, aka Preacher Boy, would have been nominated, but I guess that's slightly a snub. Although Delroy Lindo, I'm still mad about Defy Bloods. He should have won an Oscar for that. And then I was shocked to learn that he wasn't even nominated for an Oscar for Defy Bloods. So clearly this is the Academy being like, we fucked up. We're sorry, Delroy.
Right.
Here's your first Oscar nomination in your entire career.
Here's the thing. I think we put way too much stock in the Academy and their logic. Because as we've seen from like the previous movies that have been nominated for the most Oscars, like that is a mixed bag. Like All About Eve is not the fucking same as La La Land.
Oh, you know? I'm going to blow your mind. Do you remember that a film called Coda won Best Picture a few years ago? I bet you don't remember. No one remembers this.
Yeah, I didn't remember that.
Also believed to be a snub in the Best Supporting category. No, Paul Mescal. But, you know, he's too busy filming his role as Paul McCartney in that insane Beatles film that's going to be four separate films. Best Supporting Actress, Elle Fanning in Sentimental Value. Igna Isbadadar Lilias.
There's no way you got that.
You try to say it.
It's okay, fine. We can move on.
All right. Amy Madigan for Weapons. Teyana Taylor in One Battle After Another. And Wanmi Musaku in Sinners. All right, best adapted screenplay, Begonia, Frankenstein, Hamnet, One Battle After Another, and Train Dreams. Best original screenplay, Blue Moon, It Was Just an Accident, Marty Supreme, Sentimental Value, and Sinners.
Shall we talk about Sentimental Value? Because we also saw that.
We did. You know, it is billed as this film that is about an estranged father who is an eccentric creative genius, and his daughters who he tries to reconnect with. But really, it's a story about a fabulous Norwegian house over the years.
It's so true. I'm so happy being in that house. The vibes are like kind of bad sometimes, but like it always has a good energy on the whole, I would say.
What I also love about this film is there are so many films about making movies, and oftentimes you are, whether it's Ed Wood or, I don't know, what's another film like this? Boogie Nights. Like, you're in the eyes of the people making the film, and they are the heroes. And you don't really get to see the collateral cost of being a family member or a friend to someone who's a creative genius.
Totally.
Because it often sucks.
Yeah.
Like, Stellan Skarsgård as this father cannot see past movies in a very fascinating way.
I think Stellan Skarsgård could win this. He was so amazing. And this movie truly has the best clip from a fake movie that I've ever seen in my life.
I wasn't expecting how up to date this film was going to be. And I agree with you. Like, it's so difficult to show. We've talked about this. Ben Stiller is amazing at this. But in this film, you're right. Like, there's the best film within a film. Like, clearly a very serious Holocaust movie.
Like, so legit that would make you cry from just like watching like a 1 minute clip of this film.
But so many of the specific choices, like Stellan Skarsgård's director character is at a film festival. He has not made a film for 15 years. You don't know why, whether he just creatively doesn't have it anymore, can't get the funding. And he comes across Elle Fanning, who's this American actress. But they meet not at Cannes, but the Deauville Film Festival, which is like a very top tier film festival, but like the top tier of like the second rung down. Like, it's not Cannes, it's not Sundance, not Telluride. Every choice was brilliant. The fact that Stellan Skarsgård is making a Netflix movie with Elle Fanning.
And Elle Fanning was amazing. And I really love the fact that they resisted cliches about actresses that we usually see with this character, because she's famous. She obviously, or presumably, is not doing maybe a ton of art house stuff, but her character has depth and a real desire to create art and isn't flaky and is doing her best to execute this man's vision.
Right. And also, I think one of the most difficult things to portray is when an actor or an actress has to be a not very good actor.
Yeah.
Or struggling through the material.
Yeah, I get the sense that her character was a good actor, but it wasn't really clicking, obviously. Also, can we talk about the moment in this film that I think both of us will probably remember first and foremost 10 years from now?
Yes, there is one of the most every outfit coded gags in the film, where someone receives the films, the piano teacher in Irreversible, as a birthday gift.
I think we can say that it's a young child.
Okay, Stellan Skarsgård gives his grandchild, his 8-year-old grandson, the piano teacher in Irreversible as birthday presents, and points to the piano teacher and is like, you'll learn a lot about women from this film.
Women and maternal relationships is what he says. So good. So funny. That really sparked joy for me. Another thing that sparked joy from that movie was the opening nightmarish, grief-induced stage fright scene.
I forgot about that because it ends on such a high note. I forget that, yeah, it's the lead actress is an actress in Norwegian theater. And within the first 10 minutes, I mean, we have a new contender for glamorous women having a nervous breakdown.
I know. I was like, oh, I didn't realize this was one of these movies. Also, two other Oscar things I want to highlight. Firstly, this is the first time we're getting the best casting category, which is really exciting.
Right.
I personally am rooting for Jennifer Venditti, who was the casting director for Marty Supreme. She also casts Euphoria.
She did. I mean, now might be time to get into, you've seen this resurface story. Oh, wait, no, you've bricked your phone, so you probably have not seen this resurface story about the Safdie brothers and an incident that happened on the set of
Good Time. Yes, I have seen that, despite my recent brick use.
Which, I find that story, it's not funny, it's deadly serious, but that's been out for years, because when Emrata was divorcing
that guy that produced that movie.
He was the one that brought this underage girl on set who, I mean, she was 17. I hate to be this person, but like that is the legal age of consent in New York. The film was shot in New York. But like, yeah, it's not great. She's a teenage girl. This producer allegedly had a relationship with her. She was unaware that she would be half naked and, you know, have the other character in the film played by Buddy Duress, who is now dead, you know, whip his dick out and have to film a simulated sex scene. But I have seen the casting director get thrown into this of like, when is she going to comment on this? And it's like, have you read the details of the story? She didn't bring that girl in.
Even if she did, she's not responsible for the set. That's literally the director's job.
And also, the way that this story is framed from a story that has been out since 2023 is like, that's why Benny Safdie doesn't work with Josh Safdie anymore. And it's like, again, have you read the details of the story? Benny Safdie, a co-director on Good Time, was holding the boom while this scene was happening. He didn't do anything to stop it. He still shot another movie with his brother. So what are we doing with this story?
I think this story blew up again because it was the cover of the first issue of the California Post, which is the new West Coast version of the New York Post, which I have to say, kind of excited about that.
I mean,
I wish I could disengage from the New York Post and its right-wing content, but it does have Page Six.
Yeah, I don't know if we need a California version of that, but good thing there's like literally one newsstand left. Where would you even find the California Post?
But the fact that the first issue is addressing this makes me think that they do want it to be a bit more entertainment focused and perhaps compete with, say, a Deadline or a Hollywood Reporter or whatever.
At the start of every year, women are hit with the same message, new year, new you. But what if you didn't have to reinvent anything? What if real change was already happening quietly, naturally from within? That's exactly what Nutrafol believes. That real hair growth doesn't come from quick fixes or unrealistic timelines. It comes from building a routine that nourishes your body with what it needs consistently over time. Honestly, I think the only resolution I haven't broken year over year is my commitment to Nutrafol in my daily routine. That's probably why Nutrafol is the number one dermatologist recommended hair growth supplement brand trusted by over 1.5 million people. I'm still on my postpartum journey and use Nutrafol because it targets the key root causes of postpartum thinning, physical and emotional stress, hormonal changes, and nutrient depletion, so that with consistent daily use, you'll start to see thicker, fuller hair and less overall shedding. And I have to say, my hair has never looked better. Nutrafol's hair growth supplements are peer-reviewed, NSF certified for sport, and clinically tested to measure improvements in growth, quality, and strength. See thicker, stronger, faster-growing hair with less shedding in just 3 to 6 months with Nutrafol. For a limited time, Nutrafol is offering our listeners $10 off your first month subscription and free shipping when you go to Nutrafol.com and enter promo code OUTFIT. Find out why Nutrafol is the best-selling hair growth supplement brand at Nutrafol.com, spelled Nutrafol.com, promo code OUTFIT. That's Nutrafol.com, promo code OUTFIT.
Anyway, that was a digression. One last thing in a bit of Celesbian news.
Oh.
Did you notice that Tig Notaro is nominated for an Oscar?
I did not. No. Where?
She is nominated in the documentary category for the documentary that she produced about the poet Andrea Gibson, who died of ovarian cancer recently. I have not seen this film yet. Glennon Doyle was also an executive producer on it, so she wouldn't get an Oscar for it. But this is the Celesbian Oscar news.
Shall we get into some fashion?
Sure.
So in disappointing, but I guess I'm not surprised news, one of our favorite photographers, Ellen Von Unwerth, was the photographer behind the poster for Melania Trump's eponymous documentary directed by Brett Ratner. I have to say, the stark black and white image did not immediately convey Ellen Von Unwerth.
Yeah, because she wasn't like wearing lingerie and eating a plate of spaghetti.
So Melania Trump's agent, Mark Beckman, went on Fox News and did an interview and gave some pretty insane quotes. He said about Ellen Von Unwerth and Melania Trump's relationship, they worked together years ago on a campaign, and for obvious reasons, we thought it would be amazing to have Ellen involved. So the campaign that they worked on was a Camel cigarette ad from 1997.
I've seen that ad before. It makes the rounds here and there. It's one of Melania's more significant modeling gigs, which was pre-Trump, obviously.
And it was a campaign that ran in Times Square. There are photos of it on some wire service. But Melania's agent went on to say, Ellen personally was an orphan when she was young, and she is very fond of Melania's work for the foster care community. It is just an interesting part of their relationship, a sensitive component which makes their relationship even stronger.
Look, Ellen Von Unwerth is an icon of 90s fashion photography. Without her, we wouldn't have a lot of those Guess ads or the cover of Holes lived through this. But she has really, really fallen off as a photographer in a dark Lydia Tarr kind of way. The pivot to digital has degraded the quality of her work to a degree I couldn't have imagined was possible.
Well, what's equally Tarr-esque is that it's one thing to photograph a poster for a film that maybe you don't agree with the politics of the person. You know, we could at least give her that, right? Times are tough, get that bag. But Unworth also attended a screening of the documentary last Saturday night, a screening that happened the same day border agents shot and killed intensive care nurse Alex Preddy in the street in Minneapolis. Couldn't postpone the First Lady's very important screening. And why would they, Chell, when they had Apple CEO Tim Cook, the Queen of Jordan, boxer Mike Tyson, and self-help guru Tony Robbins?
Wasn't Erica Kirk there also? Like, this is a real nightmare blunt rotation kind of scenario that, frankly, I wouldn't expect Ellen Von Unwerth to be in that rotation.
No. We should also say that this documentary is directed by Brett Ratner, who has been on Cancel Man Island since 2017 when he was accused of sexual misconduct by six different women, including actresses Olivia Munn and Natasha Henstridge, although no criminal charges were filed against him. He has blessedly not worked since then.
Well, I haven't heard about Ellen Von Unwerth since she photographed Courtney and Travis's wedding. So again, I think that speaks to where she's at. But it's so sad because with some photographers, it's like they're so major up until the day that they die, like an Irving Penn or something. But then there's other people that their work just gets so bad that they become unemployable, essentially.
Right. I think it's also worth noting that while this film will be in theaters, and according to updated tracking, is going to be a box office bomb. It will be streaming on Amazon because Amazon bought the documentary for $40 million. And according to CNN, they have spent another $35 million on marketing for the documentary, which I just got to say, job not well done. I've not seen one trailer for this.
Well, also, according to the New York Times, the Trumps personally pocketed $28 million from the sale of this Melania documentary, which is obviously insanely dark.
Yeah, and this deal was announced just a few days after Jeff Bezos dined with Trump at Mar-a-Lago. So it's very clear what this is, which is like, please don't tariff me to death. See, I bought your wife's vanity documentary. Please like me, Trump. Be nice.
Yeah, this is a strategic move that, frankly, I think he would have done with anyone.
You're talking about Jeff Bezos.
Yeah, I mean, with any first lady, regardless of party.
Or first man. I mean, yeah, I do agree with you that if Kamala Harris became president in an alternate reality where things are much better and Doug Emhoff had a documentary about what it was like to be the first man in history, I think Jeff Bezos would have spent tens of millions of dollars buying that as well.
Oh, absolutely.
Speaking of currying favor, I guess we should touch on the fact that Lauren Sanchez has been ushered by Anna Wintour to many couture shows. People seem very upset by that.
They were photographed going to lunch in Paris during Couture Week. They're obviously at a lot of these same shows, but Lauren Sanchez would be at those shows anyway. She's a billionaire. These brands are owned by billionaires. When you have that much money, your world becomes kind of small.
And also, Lauren Sanchez, Bezos, and Jeff Bezos are underwriting the current Met Gala. So, of course, they would be together looking at the couture collections. I'm sure Anna Wintour is advising Lauren Sanchez what to wear.
Yeah.
Is it disappointing? Yeah, it's not great. Would we hold the same anger if a Democrat was in office? Probably. But I don't know when Anna Wintour became some sort of moral arbiter.
Well, it's also like she's always someone that has rubbed elbows with the billionaire class. People just know what Lauren Sanchez looks like, right, and know what her name is and all of that. So it's just like, this is the one billionaire you know, and she's been photographed with her.
Amy O'Dell, who wrote the biography of Anna Wintour and most recently the unauthorized Gwyneth Paltrow biography, she made this point about Anna Wintour where there was a time where Anna Wintour, you couldn't buy your way into the Met Gala. Like, if she did not approve of you, you could not buy a table no matter how much money you had. And it feels indicative of where we are with print media that it's like she is doing everything that she can, as she always has, to make sure that the structure of the Met Gala and Vogue to a lesser extent is secured.
Yeah.
Which, by the way, isn't that the end of The Devil Wears Prada? Where, like, she's got to shuffle a bunch of chairs and, I mean, metaphorically, and Stanley Tucci becomes the sacrificial lamb so that she can stay editor-in-chief at Runway?
Right. Well, it's kind of different because it's like there's a difference between buying your way in, like buying a table, and then just paying for the entire thing.
That's true. I mean, it's just where we are now.
But it's also, it's like you can buy your way in, but you have to be someone that Anna likes. It's not as if like there aren't people that are there mostly because they bought an entire table. She just has to make sure that it's not a tacky person, because if it's a tacky person, that reflects poorly on the entire event, which is what is happening with the Jeff Bezos, Lauren Sanchez thing, obviously. But maybe it's worth it if the amount of money is so great.
I mean, if not them, then who? We would like the Costume Institute funded and to keep going.
Yeah.
Here on the Every Outfit podcast, we love Cash App. From getting paid to growing what you've got, Cash App makes managing your money effortless and instant without all the fees. It's the way money should work. And Cash App just released a new status program for the way people actually spend called Cash App Green. It unlocks new ways for you to pay, get rewarded, and easily grow or manage your money on your terms. Now, when you spend at least $500 a month with the Cash App card or Cash App Pay, you earn green status, which unlocks benefits like up to $200 of free overdraft coverage, higher borrow limits, and custom personalized cashback offers every Friday at places you love to shop. Turn everyday spending into status with Cash App Green. Download Cash App today or visit cash.app/new to learn more about this and other great features launching now. For a limited time, new Cash App customers can earn $10 if they use the code CASHAPP10 in their profile at sign up and send $5 to a friend within 14 days. Terms apply. Cash App is a financial service platform, not a bank. Banking services provided by Cash App's bank partners. Prepaid debit cards issued by Sutton Bank. Member FDIC. Cash App Green, overdraft coverage, borrow, cashback offers and promotions provided by Cash App, a Block Inc. brand. Visit cash.app/legal/podcast for full disclosures.
Shall we get into couture, baby?
There were some couture shows. What would you like to start with?
I say we start with Schiaparelli just because it happened first. But for me, this was a really fascinating season. And it really highlighted how vastly different these designers are from each other, not just on an aesthetic level, but in terms of their belief system about what couture should be in 2026 and what purpose it serves. So with Schiaparelli, his approach seems more aligned with costume design. It's about like creating these different characters. He's like, I'm going to turn this bitch into a hummingbird.
Well, I was surprised. I was looking at the show notes, and I guess he gave a moniker to every look, and one look was called the Isabella Blowfish, which...
A beautiful pun. And frankly, should be a children's book that I would read. Can you imagine? It's like, Isabella Blowfish wasn't like the other fish in the ocean, because she wore corsets and had depressive episodes.
Should I write this children's book? But on that note of a look that is inspired by Isabella Blow, didn't it kind of feel like this collection was very McQueen inspired?
Well, sure. Obviously, the jacket with the wings, like the first look, immediately recalls McQueen. But it's also similarly to McQueen, this man is interested in the extremes of the body and the hourglass figure Like, these are clothes for women that, like, want to show that shit off, like a Lauren Sanchez.
Right.
And they're clothes for the sort of client that's like, I want you to see every goddamn cent I spent on this.
I did send you one of the looks, which was this corset, and then you could see, like, the underpinning of the top of the skirt, and then it was a tulle skirt. And I was like, Chelsea, if I was a couture client, which I'm not, and if I was getting married again, which I'm not, this would be my wedding dress.
Oh, it was beautiful. And I think that when we look back at this period, it's like Schiaparelli will be one of the most significant brands just because of the presence that it's had on the red carpet.
Just the other night, Margot Robbie wore a custom Schiaparelli look for the Wuthering Heights premiere.
It's pretty extraordinary what he has done, especially as an American designer.
It's funny, you forget that he is an American designer at times because of just what he does.
Well, we weren't familiar with his name when he was living in New York.
Well, I wanted to bring up that his sister, he comes from the Midwest, and his sister has a TikTok account, and she and her parents always go to the shows, and it's some of the most wholesome content. It's him dressing his Midwestern mother and sister in these Schiaparelli looks to be in the front row.
I love it. Also, I don't know if you saw Marissa Berenson at the show. I don't know how old she is at this point, but the way she looks is fucking insane. Like, she looks incredible.
She actually is a wax figure that Daniel Roseberry just assembles for each couture show. Did you know that the jewels in this collection were recreated jewelry from the Louvre heist?
Isn't that what Teyana Taylor was wearing specifically?
Yes.
Yeah. That was a fun gimmick for sure. We love this kind of storytelling. And there is so much lore and storytelling and world building with all of these Schiaparelli shows.
I do feel at this point, and, you know, we'll get into it, we have two new contenders in the couture game. But at this point, like, he is the elder statesman, and he's kind of only competing with himself at this point.
I think he's competing most directly with Alessandro Michele and what he's doing at Valentino, because he's also a designer that is approaching couture in a manner that does feel more like costume design. Like, he's making clothes for an opera that we've never seen or some very high budget showgirl review.
Well, should we just hop into the Valentino show then?
Sure.
I don't know what was more major, the clothes themselves or the staging.
It was all great. The staging was certainly unexpected. And if you guys haven't seen the show, he basically set up like a bunch of peep shows. Like, it was almost like a bunch of rooms where there was like, I don't know, eight people maybe per room or something that the models walked in and out of. And then everyone watched the show through these peepholes. So you couldn't see the audience, which made it visually very different from any other fashion show, because that's just part of the experience, right? You go in a fashion show, you can't help but look at other people, what they're wearing, how they're reacting, what they're doing. So to sort of eliminate the audience entirely.
Yeah, in the show notes, he discussed the fact that this staging was inspired by a 19th century art form called Kaiser Panorama, where people would, this predates films, and people would just go, as you described, like, look into these peepholes and see a kind of 360, you know, this is what Rome looks like or something like that. And to use that for a fashion show. And it's very funny. I don't know if you've watched the show video, but they have, you know, everyone arriving. Because looking at fashion shows now, everyone's on their fucking phones. And this really stopped people from doing that. But, like, in the videos before the show starts, you just see people on their cell phones, and then they're forced to get off of them to look through this tiny window.
No, but they put the phones, like, through the holes. What are you talking about? Like, half of the photos I saw was just, like, you just see people's phones coming out of the peepholes. I mean, for me, because I'm a child of the 80s, I was just like, oh, this is just like the Open Your Heart music video.
I was just about to say, yeah, yeah. Or Paris, Texas.
So can we talk about not the big shows, but I guess the most talked about shows?
Sure.
Let's start with Dior.
This is Jonathan Anderson's couture debut. And in many respects, it was a continuation on the ideas he presented in his ready-to-wear collection. Like, literally the first three looks are just longer versions of dresses he did in his ready-to-wear collection, but instead of being made by machine, they were made by hand.
And like, truly, this is like the opposite of Schiaparelli, this show. Like, I guess there's also sort of a body modification element to it, but it's like a complete opposite way of thinking about what couture should be and like what a woman should look like. Like, it doesn't seem like Jonathan Anderson cares about showing the body at all in that way, which is not to say that there weren't some like slinky gowns that were beautiful and stuff, but a lot of it was very sculptural. A lot of it was like Bjork friendly, as I would say. Like, for a couture show, typically when you watch one of them, practically never do I think like, wow, Bjork could actually wear like half of this shit. But she could, truly. It's like deeply cerebral clothing for full-blown freaks that also have a feminine side.
Yeah, there were a lot of bulbous shapes, I would say. But I did feel like it was inspired by Galliano. He was in the audience. Or if not in the audience, he got a preview. I was listening to something Jonathan Anderson was saying.
He was in the audience.
Okay. And the advice that Galliano gave him when John Galliano came to the studio for a preview was, the more you love the brand, the more it will give back to you. And I felt like in particular, the hairstyling and the flower accessories, like those flower ball earrings, felt very 2000, early aughts Galliano couture.
Oh, for sure. And there were references to stuff he had designed throughout the show. But also a lot of it reminded me of Raf's couture stuff, maybe more so because of the color palette and the way that both of them translated some of those ball gown shapes, but in a way that was just more like streamlined and minimal and obviously made in the modern era.
Yeah, I think, myself included, I think people think of couture being a very particular thing, a very unwearable, as you said, body modification. And it was interesting to see clothes that were almost had a quotidian, everyday nature to them.
I don't know if I would describe this as everyday, like maybe some of the coats.
There was one particular look. I guess I'm talking about the knits in particular, which it seems like his hook into couture, which backstage he was talking about his own kind of confused relationship with couture, because he was like, I was trying to find what the purpose was. And then I applied it to how I love the craft and I realized, well, it's just an endangered craft. So how do we protect it? And so he became very interested in the knits. In particular, there is, you are correct, a very like Bjork-esque, voluminous, almost fisherman-esque V-neck sweater, but then also matched with this black skirt with what I'll call like blob appliques. But like, there's like a high slit in the thigh. And I'm like, that is season four Carrie Bradshaw.
Well, yeah, to bring it back to the craft of it all, so much of what he did at Loewe was about craft and collaborating with these highly specific international artisans. And now he has free range at the Dior Atelier, which is obviously like God-tier craftsmanship. But from my standpoint, his mentality about couture and all of this is that it shouldn't be old and dusty and completely chained to the past. I think he's someone that is always looking to subvert aspects of conventional pieces that we're used to and pieces that we know and love and make it so that something looks off.
For sure. But he also made a very beautiful bridal look as the final look. And I was just imagining, like, I'm sure there are several billionaires' daughters getting married in 2027 who are like, I want that.
Yeah, that was definitely more conventional. And there certainly were looks like that. I really liked this one sort of asymmetric white feathered gown that came midway through the show. It almost looked like there was like a feathered stole that was sort of hanging down the back of it. It was gorgeous. So there are like conventionally beautiful pieces. It's just a bit more challenging, I think, than certainly what we've been used to seeing at Dior under Maria Grazia.
For sure. And I think what's interesting, and I imagine we'll get into Matu Blazy's Chanel collection in a second, but like these are two designers making their couture debut who seem more interested in how their ready-to-wear collections can influence couture and not the other way around, which I feel like is how it used to be for designers who were at houses that had couture and ready-to-wear. Like, I feel like in the Galliano days, the couture collections were influencing and would get trickled down the concepts from that into the ready-to-wear.
Right. Yeah, no, I agree. It does seem like the reverse. Yeah, because I think that these are both designers that are thinking about sort of real fashion or everyday fashion first, and not designers whose first instinct is to think like, what is the most extreme over-the-top fantasy that I could produce in the way that maybe a Galliano might think that way, I think, first and foremost.
Well, yes. I don't see Jonathan Anderson dressing up like the themes of his couture collections when he walks out.
No. I also want to say before we move on, I really thought the opening looks were so great in the show, that trio of bulbous plissé dresses with the bows at the hem. I thought those were gorgeous, and I hope that someone wears one of those to the Oscars.
Yeah, it makes things very exciting. I think as celebrities are more fashion forward, it's always exciting to look at the couture collections and see the possibilities of what could be on the red carpet. I'm just going to call it now. I'm going to assume Teyana Taylor is going to be in Schiaparelli, custom Schiaparelli, on the red carpet at the Oscars.
As she should. They really did her a solid with that Golden Globes look. So more of that.
All right.
Chanel.
The other big show.
Also a very hard pivot, but in a different way, I guess, because his approach really seems to be about pragmatism and wearability and questioning, does couture have to be these massive, lavish, over-the-top gowns?
And I think his focus is about the materials rather than the ideas, right? It's not like a maximalist dress with a gigantic silhouette and that's why it's so expensive. It's the materials that really you have to get up close and look at the details to really understand the craft that went into it. Not that they're...
Oh, for sure.
From afar, they're all beautiful clothing, but...
For sure, but it's not things that you can tell are expensive from like 100 feet away, which is the case with some of these other shows that we've been talking about.
There has been this conversation online. I would be curious to get your opinion, which is like, what is couture? Because people are making the point of like, well, to me, couture is fantasy. And other people are like, well, no, couture, the true definition of it is about the craft, doing things by hand.
It's about the craft and it's up to the designer to determine what they want to do with that. I think this show was great. I think it felt modern, not in a futuristic sense. Like a lot of these silhouettes look like they could be from the 1920s, but I think it's modern in its rejection of excess.
Well, I think it is clear that Matu is inspired by less Karl Lagerfeld's output at Chanel and more Coco herself.
And thank fucking God. Like, honestly, I'm shocked, actually. Not that I didn't think that he was a good designer. I thought he was a great designer. But I didn't think that he would sort of absorb the mentality of Coco to this degree.
Right.
And the bridal look, I mean, genius. A top and a skirt. A bridal look that a woman of a certain age could wear for her second or third wedding that does not have unintended Dion Arbus subtext.
Are you referring to past and now current Chanel brand ambassador Nicole Kidman for her potential third marriage?
I don't know if that would be the right choice for Nicole. But I appreciate the fact that he's thinking about the reality that Chanel is a brand that is worn by a lot of older women. Like when I think of Chanel in my head or the Chanel client, I associate it with an older woman.
Right.
And I feel like with Karl Lagerfeld or typically like with Chanel brand ambassadors and the models in the show, in recent years, it has been this sort of, you know, everyone looks like Lily Rose Depp or Gracie Abrams or something. I really think that the way that the diversity that he has brought to the casting in terms of race and in terms of age is really powerful and feels really fresh. And these women look major. And let's be real, like Chanel couture is not going to be mostly worn by girls in their 20s. It's just not.
Well, now they've expanded to Jacob Elordi, so... Before we move on, just a comment. I had this thought when I was looking at the Dior collection, especially the Chanel collection, and this conversation about, for lack of a better phrase, the more pedestrian couture that we're seeing. I can't help but feel like it is a reflection of the fact that natural fibers at this point in fabrics are a luxury. If you look at the mid-range brands, everything is polyester. If you want to buy a new wool pant, it's $800.
Yeah.
Not that either of these designers are overtly referencing that, but I feel like this is all in conversation with each other.
Well, the way he used sheer fabrics was kind of central to this show. And actually, a lot of those looks, like in the beginning of the show, or like the look that basically looked like a wife beater and jeans or something, or pants that were completely sheer, it's like that almost owes more to Helmut Lang or like a Prada than Coco Chanel, which I thought was interesting. And the clear bags, I mean, that was incredible.
Yeah, the gauzy bags.
Yeah. And like such a perfect couture piece, because, I mean, it's not functionless, but it's a piece that only makes sense for someone that already has several other Chanel handbags. I just wonder, like, what happens when you put an iPhone in there? Like, does the shape of the bag change, like, radically? Or can it accommodate, like, a lipstick? Or, like, what can we do with that bag?
That bag is so delicate that if you put an iPhone in it, it goes straight through.
Also, like, the thing in this show that almost felt the least Chanel to me was the mushroom motif that we right. saw in some of the embroideries and also in the set. When I said that this show was a rejection of excess, I didn't mean the set. The set was fucking crazy. And the set was, like, more, like, aligned with what we saw in the Carl era, certainly. But it was fun. It was just, to me, mushrooms, like, a very, like, Pacific Northwest vibe. You know, which to me doesn't, like, fungus and Chanel are not things I usually would put in the same sentence.
Well, you know, I always like to look at the show notes. And he said that he was inspired by a haiku about a bird and a mushroom.
These fashion designers are fucking crazy.
I feel like that's the hardest thing. I just want one designer to be like, I don't know, I just thought this looked cool. Why do I have to be inspired by something obscure?
I mean, they literally have to, though, because when you're making that many collections a year, like, if you don't have something to grasp onto for dear life or some sort of framework to develop a collection, I don't know, I would think that would be harder almost.
I guess so. But when they're doing 70 looks, it's like, you know what? This couldn't have all been inspired by a three-line haiku about a bird and a mushroom.
Also, R.I.P. Valentino Garavani. It is the end of an era.
Yes, he died, I think, 2 weeks ago, January 13th, and his funeral was last Friday. And when I was looking at the photos of Tom Ford and Anna Wintour and Anne Hathaway, I was like, these Italians, they know how to do a funeral.
Yeah, they do. Although you did send me a photo of his coffin, which was in this brightly lit room with these orchids. And you're like, this is giving John James Preston's funeral. And it was. That was literally the first thing that came to mind for me as well.
I had to find a couple other sources because I'm like, this can't really be his memorial, can it? And it was. So I have to imagine that Samantha Jones sent the flowers. A dear former client of Samantha Jones PR.
I'm like imagining Giancarlo Giametti like opening the card. Love, Samantha. I feel so bad for him. My God. Because that's been his work wife for 10,000 years.
Yeah, like 60 years.
And his ex-boyfriend. Also, if you haven't seen Valentino, The Last Emperor, I think that's one of the better fashion documentaries of that era, certainly. Lots of pug content, if you're into that.
Well, you know I am. Okay. I know we're a week late to this, but can we discuss the Queer Eye drama?
Sure.
So, in the run-up to the new and final season of Queer Eye, the Fab Five, of course, was set to do a couple of talk shows, and Karamo did not join. It was actually the Fab Four, and this started when they went on CBS Morning and learned through Gail that Karamo wouldn't be joining them, in part to, quote, to protect his mental health slash peace for people or a world who seek to destroy it, which is why I can't be there today. Gail added that his assistant said Karamo feared being bullied.
Just them reading this statement in front of the Fab Four was one of the most insane things I've ever watched.
Antony's response was, we're a family and families are complicated. Which I was like, okay, so some shit really did go down. This then continued. I mean, Karamo's assistant, like, fucking terrorizing them. Because what I saw first was the NBC clip, which is even crazier because the Fab Four, I imagine, afterwards went to NBC where they were, like, further terrorized by a new statement. There was, like, more shit Karamo's assistant wanted them to hear. So a statement that was read during this appearance was, Karamo has felt mentally and emotionally abused for years and has been advised by his therapist to protect his peace by not attending. And then he sent this video message.
Hey, Jenna and Chanel, congratulations on becoming the most amazing duo on daytime TV. I just want to say thank you to all the fans who supported us and rocked with us for 10 seasons. This new season is going to be amazing. You're going to love every minute of it. And just like the themes of this season, I'm modeling what I believe is most important, which I want to remind you all, love yourselves and protect yourselves. That's why I'm here at home and not there. But continue to watch the show. The crew worked on it and did an amazing job. I want to shout out to the crew. I want to shout out to all the fans. I want to shout out to the executives from Netflix. Thank you for having me for 10 seasons.
People notice that someone is missing.
That sounds like in between the CBS appearance and the NBC appearance, a Netflix executive got a hold of his representatives and were like, he's in breach of contract for not promoting the show. Because, like, to be like, and by the way, you should watch the show. Thank you to the crew. And Netflix is great. And anyway, everyone watch it.
Well, to be fair, he did a great job of promoting the show.
I had no intention of watching this 10th season, and I watched that first episode.
Yeah, it's actually unintentionally incredibly brilliant marketing for this series. Also, I just want to clarify, I think when Karamo is saying, like, in so many words, fuck these guys, they're bullying me, I do not believe he is including Jeremiah Brent in that group.
And that is because Jeremiah Brent is the only person that he's still following on Instagram?
Yeah, I'm going to try and explain this in a way that sounds reasonably sane, but yes, Karamo follows Jeremiah and he follows Bobby Burke, which was, you know, the previous interiors guy on Queer Eye that left. And they both follow him back. But JVN, Tan, and Anthony, this seems to be the toxic trio, they are not followed by Bobby. They don't follow Bobby back. And they also don't follow Karamo. And Karamo doesn't follow them back.
And we think the reason for this fracture in their friendship is TMZ reported after all of this went down that the reason Karamo doesn't fuck with them is because his mother was visiting the latest season of Queer Eye and was handed by production a set of headphones, and Karamo, I guess, in between setups, walked out of the room, and Karamo's mother heard Tan France, Anthony, and JVN talking shit about his, quote, lifestyle choices.
And also his clothes, I heard. I mean, were they like, he's wearing another baseball jacket and, well, another baseball hat?
Were the lifestyle choices his clearly overfilled face?
Okay, I don't know about that, but they're not one to talk. And they're also not one to talk about fashion. I mean, Anthony, fine, sure. But like, Tan and JVN regularly look crazy, you know?
I agree with you.
The funniest aspect of this for me is the post that Bobby Burke did on Instagram, or maybe it was on Twitter. It was just a photo of him, and it was like, how is your week going? My new show, Junker Jackpot, is now on HGTV. And the song he used was Chapel Roan's My Kink is Karma, which suggests that he sides with Karamo, and he's like, fuck Tan, fuck JVN, fuck Anthony. Like, now it's coming out what pieces of shit they are, basically.
But again, quite like the Safdie story where it's like, this came out 3 years ago. In 2024, there was a Rolling Stone expose about how toxic all of these people are.
But that was more centered around, like, JVN being a monster to the crew and stuff.
Having, wait, I love this, rage issues was the quote.
Exactly. But as I recall, it didn't get so into, like, the allegiances within the cast or this toxic trio of Jen, Tan, and Anthony. It was also like, oh my God, watching them all hold hands.
Yes, for those who haven't seen the clip, either the CBS one or the Today Show one, they are all holding hands with each other while this is happening.
But yeah, I don't know. Obviously, we can never really know what exactly happened, but I'm inclined to side with Bobby and Karamo. and Jeremiah, who's the only one that everyone follows out of all of them, including Bobby.
Jeremiah, a man who has always come out unscathed on reality shows. We talked about this when he joined the cast. My memory of him is he got his start on the Rachel Zoe Project as one of her assistants who was like, I'm not into fashion, I'm into interiors. How do I fit in? And then it's like Rachel was having a baby and he got to redecorate her new rental.
He's a great addition to the show. Not that I didn't love Bobby. I loved Bobby too, but I just think that he's doing God's work.
Well, all of the interior designers on Queer Eye are doing the Lord's work. So I watched, did you watch the first episode of this latest season?
Oh my God, I was like sobbing. And I love Queer Eye. Like, I watch Queer Eye, I've watched every season of Queer Eye. To me, it's like, while I do obviously find some of them to be annoying at times, I find it to be a really moving, heartwarming show. And I love a makeover show also.
Every time I dip into Queer Eye, it's just like the labor is not even. Like, Anthony's literally just making a cake. By the way, that the sisters make. It's the mother's recipe. And he's like, I'm done here. And like,
no, it's actually crazy. It's like Karamo did more in that episode, but sometimes Karamo also does nothing.
And Jeremiah in what, 2.5 days, redoes their entire house?
Yeah, and you know that he's working on a tight budget.
Is now a good time to get into Bobby Burke's new HGTV show?
Junk or Jackpot.
Which makes it seem like it's a show about where Bobby Burke goes in and assesses whether people's collections are worthwhile. But really, you described it so aptly.
Well, it is like Antiques Roadshow in that respect. It's about transforming the houses of people that have collections. There's all sorts of different kinds of people with all sorts of different collections. And these people have to partially finance their own renovations by selling pieces from the collection. It's kind of like Antiques Roadshow meets Hoarders, because some of these people are like psycho freaks, like with obvious like mental issues, meets like just like an HGTV show.
But what Bobby is doing is he's like, I'm gonna make this work. At best, these people have the IKEA PAX bookcases. At worst, it's unorganized. And basically what he does is like, I'm gonna make a beautiful glass enclosed several structures so that your boyfriend can move back into your apartment in the case of the first episode. Watching that entire first episode, so that guy collects Disney-related figurines and pinball machines.
I love how Bobby like totally dragged him and he was like, because your collection is non-specific, like I think you actually just are a hoarder.
But I could not see past the fact that the guy in the first episode just looked like Nicolas Cage doing a character. Like, it just seemed like Nicolas Cage with a big bushy beard playing a Disney adult.
I can see that. I can see that.
However, when you were selling me this show, you were like, it is Hoarders meets Antiques Roadshow, which like I'm into. But you were like, it's so great. They have to sell their stuff to pay for these renovations. And I'm sorry, but in the first episode, that is a fake auction. I do not believe.
Oh, I don't believe that's real either.
But in the second episode, where the guy has to sell his old games at some sort of convention, I'm like, that's real.
Yeah, for sure. The craziest one was, I don't know if you got to the episode where it was a guy that had like Magic the Gathering shit.
No, but that stuff's very expensive and collectible.
This one card was worth like $100,000. And he's like, I refuse to sell it. They didn't even need like that much money for the renovations. It was like he was trying to get like, I don't know, $28,000 or something like from his stuff. And I'm like, the fact that you just have that card sitting there and aren't just like, I'm going to sell this and just like buy another house. Like, it's crazy to me.
Oh, yeah. There is a problem going on in the San Fernando Valley right now where people are robbing these Pokemon Magic the Gathering card stores because all these cards are so valuable.
I get it. But you kind of also have to be a fucking nerd to know how much some of this shit is worth.
Of course. I thought that you would be taken with the third episode with the woman who has the doll collection.
Oh, totally. Although she wasn't like the biggest freak of them all. You know what I mean? Like, she seems like mentally a little more there than some of the other people. But yeah, she was a Barbie freak, a Mattel freak.
I mean, I would love to see you as you become a woman of a certain age. Like her, you start making like dioramas and photographing and filming different scenes with your Barbies.
I'll save that for my next mental health crisis.
Okay, I think we've come to the end of the show, which we've long discussed the fact that we never know how to end the show. And guys, we've had a breakthrough. We think we know how to end the show now. Because, I mean, truly, every week we get stuff wrong.
Yeah, we always fuck something up. So we thought it would be fun to start issuing corrections and apologizing publicly for our mistakes at the end of the podcast. So, Lauren, you have something to apologize for?
Guys, I'm very sorry that in last week's episode, I erroneously said that JR was shot in a dream. I don't know where I got that. I blame I Love the 80s.
You're talking about the television show Dallas.
Yes, I'm talking about the television show Dallas. For people who didn't listen to last week's rewatch episode, we noted that Carrie is wearing this vintage white denim jacket that has...
I shot JR in like some sort of glitter iron-on applique situation.
And so I was trying to give context for what that means to our younger listeners. And I said that the conclusion or the answer to who shot JR on the season finale of, I don't even want to say which season. I don't want to get another thing wrong, but on this one of the season finales of Dallas.
Lauren's going to have to watch every season of fucking Dallas.
I said that when the show came back, we learned it was all a dream and people were disappointed, which I must have gotten from learning about this on I Love the 80s. One of the comedians must have said it was a dream and I just logged that. In reality...
How dare you throw Michael Ian Black under the bus like that?
In reality, it was revealed to be Kristen Shepherd, who was JR's scheming sister-in-law and mistress, who'd shot him in a fit of anger. JR didn't press charges, as Kristen claimed she was pregnant with his child as a result of their affair.
Thank you for that, Lauren. Now,
but I feel like, Chelsea, I'm not the only one who has to apologize for something. Or is this a correction?
I would like to apologize for forgetting the name of the third fairy godmother from Sleeping Beauty. Her name was Meriwether, and she did have the best personality out of the three of them, so I shouldn't have done her dirty like that. I am deeply sorry for the pain that I have caused to Disney adult fuckettes everywhere.
All right, that does it for the podcast. What will we apologize for next week?
Oh, God, I don't even want to know.
Stay tuned.
Bye, guys.
Bye.